You have tuned in to an encore presentation of Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM. Thanks so much for listening.
Hello, I'm Dave Willingham with a quick editor's note. Due to an audio issue, we lost the first few minutes, and we begin this episode with a clip of City Council member April Barker speaking before the Housing Town Hall at Bellingham High School on June 13th.
Something that the council has decided we need to reach out in different ways than just Monday evenings and three-minute opportunities for comment, that we could help educate the public on what's happening across the U.S., up and down the I-5 corridor, and then what's unique to Bellingham. And then I think also just to break that barrier a little bit and try to interact with people in different ways. Yeah, I think the perfect outcome would be have a real balanced discussion with the panel. I think if the panel could help give people perspective from that national Washington State and then Whatcom County Bellingham view, and then we could have that information to keep distributing through YouTube channel to other people as they come into the conversation. I think the best outcome would be people coming with an open mind. Typically, people come set in their position, and it's really hard to have a discussion from there. So, yeah, open-mindedness, I think a balanced conversation, and just kicking this off with people who really want to solve the problem, I think progressively, maybe move from resist to resolve. When I'm out in the public, I hear overwhelmingly that people are ready for that resolve. They're ready for changes. They understand that they're not going to be able to afford the same type of home that their parents afforded. They want to see their communities more diverse, and they understand that means a diverse set of housing types. They want to protect against urban sprawl, and they understand that means infill. But when it really comes to those public opportunities to speak and talk to council formally, we don't hear as many of those voices. So I think getting people out that are thinking those things and want to come and help with the solutions would be awesome.
April Barker, she was talking about what she hoped and expected for the town hall and what they were looking for from the citizens. And Tim, I'm kind of wondering, where has the council been up till now?
Well, it's really great that you chose a clip from April in particular, because I think she and Dan Hamill, I think, are the two stars on the council regarding this issue. He comes at it from the head. She kind of comes at it from the heart. She's very tuned into what Bellingham is going to look like in 30 or 40 years, and we need to be planning for that kind of city right now. And we need to be accommodating that and inviting that in our community. And so I think she's very wired in on that particular issue. This housing thing is affordable housing is a gigantic problem. And, housing prices are through the roof right at the moment. There's no vacancy rate, and therefore you get what you demand. It's a seller's market. And when things are running that red hot, there's not really time to come in with public policy to try to, create a space for, people of lower income, people that aren't there to pay out top dollar for their homes.
Well, I guess the question I'm asking, and I hear you about April Barker, she was talking to me yesterday about how she's a landlord, but she started in a trailer park and she's lived in so many different capacities that she does have great insight to what it's like to exist under different conditions. But this is not a situation that just erupted overnight. So I guess between the current city council and previously, what, if anything, had the city done to sort of forestall this?
Well, I think I think the city's been kind of terrible on this issue. Earlier in the decade, they were putting together an infill toolkit, and they were trying to get buy-in from a lot of different people. You get pushback on infill from existing neighborhoods because, according to city zoning, you cannot do infill in single-family neighborhoods. And when you buy a house in a zone like that, you have an expectation about what's going to happen in your neighborhood into the future. That's what the purpose of zoning is.
And a lot of people talked about the phrase infill toolkit last night. I don't know that anybody really unpacked that phrase. I mean, is there a literal toolkit that you open up in the middle of the street? Give us some...
Yeah, it's basically a policy framework that allows for different kinds of housing types. And, these could be detached dwelling units. They can be what you might call a mother-in-law apartment. They could be a carriage house. You have a big lot and you're not using it. And so you might be able to build a modest dwelling space there and offer it at a reasonable rent out. And there's a win-win there because somebody gets a place to live and maybe you shave down your own mortgage. And so what the infill toolkit is it's kind of just a little set of blueprints that would allow somebody that's considering doing some infill in a neighborhood where it's permitted, knows what's available, knows where the city codes are, the development codes, the permitting process, basically just get themselves familiarized. But the next thing that happened was the economy blew out in 2007, 2008. And, I think the city had other things on its mind besides addressing affordable housing. But, in my mind, that would have been the perfect time to be doing it because the construction industry was basically flatlined. And, the city could have induced some affordable housing development in that period of time through some kind of bond or something like that. And had that kind of construction going on while the housing market was collapsed. Now that it's red hot, it's hard to do it.
Yeah, I guess my questions about that are around which neighborhoods have an infill toolkit or the zoning to be able to do that and which don't. And my assumption, and I don't know, and maybe you can fill me in, is that it's, the poorer communities where our communities of color are and people that are using Section 8 and other supports. And, where you go down Alabama and Texas and you've got apartments back to back in alleys.
Yes, correct.
And not the highest condition apartments,
no.
As we heard.
Right. And you're right. And there is an elitism going on in Bellingham. And the meeting last night was it was a very polite and thoughtful meeting. I was actually surprised at how thoughtful the comments were and how generous people were in their remarks to the panel and to the people that were listening. But there's a lot of contention and heat around it because these older existing neighborhoods have forced all this out. And so if you've got yours and everybody else can, go hang, I guess is kind of how it has been for a long time in Bellingham.
Yeah, and I want to say, just for the record, that a couple of weeks ago on this show, I expressed some concern about what this town hall was going to be and, said that I didn't want it to be just a bunch of people talking and the council not responding. And to the council's credit, this meeting was only about 50% that. But I think a lot of good stuff was said. I think there were actually some very good ideas that were presented. But Tim's got it perfectly there. There's not the political will to change things in a lot of the established neighborhoods. So the infill is pushed out. There's, a lot of fancy plans like the See Home Way, Urban Village plan. All looks great on paper, but you got to look at who you're pushing out there. And so, yeah, it was not quite what I was hoping for.
And one of the panelists last night from the Department of Commerce in Olympia, he pointed out that these older neighborhoods used to have all kinds of housing forms in them. And when Bellingham was a young and a new town and before it had this enforced zoning, you could put up just about anything you wanted. And that meant affordability. So when you start putting in, I look at it. There's two things impacting this. One is a Growth Management Act that says that cities can't sprawl outward. And then the city also has its zoning that says that you can't move inward either. And so
this
is what's
areas,
happening. Yes.
Yeah. So let's talk about that panel. And that's one of the things that the council did, I think, well, was instead of just sitting there like lumps having us yell at them, they brought in a panel. And the panel sort of set the stage and put it in context. So who they had, Tim, you were talking about Tim Kelleher, who's involved in housing at the Washington State Department of Commerce. We had Rick Sepler, who's our Bellingham Planning Director, Greg Winter from the Opportunity Council. He's the Executive Director, but he was the former Homeless Services Manager for several years, and Rose Lathrop, who is a Sustainable Connections Green Buildings Program Manager, and they really put our situation in context. One of the things, it was a very fact-heavy presentation, but one of the things Tim Kelleher did was give us quite a sense of how this situation is not unique to us. It's happening all over Washington. It's happening all over the country. And he made the point that when things are economically successful, that makes housing worse. And Dave, I think you had some other insights about his facts.
Well, I was very happy that he brought up federal study that showed that Washington State was the fastest growing economy in 2016, because that is true. And, you know, like he said, with that comes this crisis of what do we do to house people when the market is like it is here. And I really feel like we are, and he kind of hinted at it, but I really feel like we're at this point where we are early enough in the process that it doesn't have to happen. You know, we don't have to experience what's going on in Seattle. We don't have to experience what has happened in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know, we're not there yet. There's still a chance that we can forestall that. And you know, I was very happy to see that. And you know, but the numbers that we have are numbers that we've known for a long time. You know, we know the effect of rent increases on homelessness. You know, we know how these things are correlated and how they work out. But what we haven't figured out is what to do with that next. And I'm really hoping that the next of these promised events gets into that. And instead of people talking to the council, I'd like to hear from the council members what they'd like to do.
And we're going to take just a listen, a quick clip of Greg Winter and then Rose Lathrop and Rick Sepler. And if you want to hear the whole thing, you can find it through the City of Bellingham website and their YouTube channel. But let's just listen to a couple clips from last night.
One of the answers, a partial answer, to the affordable housing problem for low-income renters that and now is at risk of not being able to be used in the community. So one policy response to that I'm pleased that some people are considering and many communities have implemented is a source of income discrimination ordinance. Essentially what it does, it augments the existing jurisdiction's fair housing law about what types of discrimination are disallowed, for example, race, ethnicity, you know, sexual orientation, et cetera, and adds source of income to that list.
We need to start exploring these options of how we can find innovative housing solutions within our existing neighborhoods, the places where our low-income populations need it the most. They need to be close to our services. They need to be close to transportation. They deserve to have the same cute, charming neighborhoods that we all in our single-family homes deserve. So really, I just wanted to kind of point out that there's so much opportunity to do beautiful infill projects that are designed well that hit all of the targets.
This is an issue that isn't every conversation that goes on in City Hall now. People spend their days working to see better ways to proceed. The city, and I can attest to this, is doing just about everything that is legally allowed at this point in time. We've pursued avenues we never thought possible. We've added a story in terms of light frame construction by adopting a change in our building code that we spearheaded in Olympia, so that multifamily housing could go to 6 stories of light frame over a plinth of concrete. That extra story provides greater housing opportunity. We have acknowledged that it's a very complex issue. There's no one silver bullet. If there was one silver bullet that we could consider that would change everything, I would assure you we would have offered it up and done it.
That was Rick Sepler, our Bellingham Planning Director, talking about how we have done everything that we legally could do. Before that, Rose Lathrop from the Sustainable Connections Green Buildings Program Manager, and we started with Greg Winter talking about discrimination in terms of income. You're listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris with Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and Melora Christensen. How did that panel hit you, Melora, when you were listening last night?
Well, I thought it was a nice perspective to have the four of them up there. For me, I'm working with individuals mostly either, you know, on very limited income. And so what I thought was really interesting was when the Department of Commerce gentleman was talking about, you know, the cost is rising, but income is staying the same. And I just think it's pertinent to note that the raise for people on Social Security this last year was $4. So, you know, they went from like, you know, $7.37 to $7.41. So not only do we, you know, need a minimum wage that could help with this, but, you know, people who have a disability, people who are really suffering, there's simply no way to do that. And when you get that golden ticket, which is in the past, it was a Section 8 voucher, people can't use them.
And Melora, does that also affect senior citizens?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And do they qualify for Section 8 housing as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Section 8 is a, you know, there's some income qualifications there. And our housing authority does a lottery style thing. So they just had an open lottery for a month. They wanted 2,000. They were going to have 2,000 people apply. Only 1,200 did, which is interesting. So everybody got the lottery. And now over the next 2 years, they'll be giving those out. But the reality is that people cannot use them. And so then once they lose it, then they just go on to the next person.
So it's my understanding that, first of all, you might not automatically get Section 8. This time they did. But maybe in the future you might not automatically get it.
And you would have to sign up.
Right. You would have to. Right. And then you get it. But it's a time-limited voucher that if you don't find housing within a certain amount of time, then that it expires.
Mm-hmm. And you can do an extension, but you have to prove that you went to this many places and they all told you no. And if you maybe are struggling with mental health or substance use, or you have a crisis in your life, you may or may not be able to do that. So they are pretty good about giving extensions. I mean, the Housing Authority knows that people aren't able to use them right now because of the vacancy rate. But, you know, here was this solution to homelessness and housing, and now that solution, which is coming from federal dollars, is no longer a solution.
Right. And just to unpack that a little bit, when you have a vacancy rate as low as we have in Bellingham, which is about 1%, and you've got a turnover on vacancies of, you know, 8 or 9 days, so it's a red hot market, there is no compelling interest for a private property owner to accept one of these Section 8 vouchers when they can just why should they hassle with the paperwork?
Yep.
when they've got hundreds of people applying for the same apartment? And that's one of the issues that City of Bellingham is struggling with in terms of trying to essentially make it illegal to discriminate against the source of one's income. But I don't know that it's going to have a practical effect because of the vacancy rate.
So that was what Greg Winter was just talking about. And what is the process for that to happen? Is it likely that we're going to have this amended to our discrimination clauses to include income?
Well, I think they're going to work on that. But, you know, the question is whether that's going to be a meaningful policy that is enforceable. It seems to me like there's a lot of wiggle room for a private developer, a private property owner to say, yeah, well, we looked at that, but we also looked at other things and we chose that person over there. And that happens every time we look at a Section 8 is we find a reason not based on the Section 8, but just based, you know, on what the market will bear to bring somebody else into this unit.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that when you have hundreds of people applying and you can just filter through just by saying, well, that's going to be complicated. And there was someone who made a comment yesterday who used to work at Apex, you know, and he said, we didn't deal with it because it was too much hassle, it was extra work. And then on top of that, who has Section 8? I mean, I think people that are qualifying for Section 8 also sometimes have a lot going on in their life, and a landlord can blatantly discriminate. Whether or not they're putting it on their Craigslist ad, great, like that shouldn't be happening. But are those people really going to be able to fill their housing voucher? Probably not.
Yeah, and I've been in that position where I was eligible and frankly needed some sort of assistance and was terrified. You know, if I go through this, what's that going to mean? You know, I've lived in areas that were heavily Section 8, but, you know, not being in a explicitly friendly environment, I really did feel if I go through this process, I'm gone. I'm out. I'm going to wind up somewhere else.
And the other thing I think about with people who, not everybody who applies for Section 8, but there are some people who are already facing challenges in everyday life, whether it's a physical disability or a mental or emotional disability, for whatever reason, that it's so frustrating, as with everything else, that the hoops that somebody has to jump through are 10 times harder when they need 10 times as much help.
That's true, but you know, I think what really came strongly through to me at the forum was the wide scale tragedy of the fact that just even ordinary people who don't qualify for any sort of a program, something that you would think of as so basic as to have an affordable and safe place to live, is just simply denied in the city of Bellingham. I mean, it's a huge crisis. I mean, it's, you know, the lower down on the spectrum, income spectrum you are, the more intensely felt the impacts are. But as they were talking about last night, you can be at 100% of the median income level and still not be able to find a place to live in Bellingham. And well, I think it was the statistic they gave was that 80% of the people, of the renters in Bellingham, are living in a place that they on paper cannot afford to live in.
And I just also think, you know, the property management companies and people who are renting, they can make that, so they will. And it kind of goes back to this question of who do we want in our communities, and do we want it to be as segregated as it already is? Do we want that to increase when we already have areas of town that are, you know, very concentrated with families that are struggling financially?
Absolutely. And you are tuned into Cascadia News Now, and you're listening to KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and KMRE.org. I'm Stephanie Contouris, our guest tonight, Melora Christensen from the Bellingham Associate Director of Catholic Community Services. And we heard a variety of people's feedback last night. So what happened was, if you weren't there and you didn't have a chance to watch, we had that panel that we talked about, and then there were questions that came from Facebook, and some of those questions were actually pretty good, and then it was just comments from the public, and City Council was all there. I think every council person was there, and the mayor was supposed to leave, but she stayed for the whole thing, and so I think that they were just listening, which was really good. But what was interesting to me is it, as often is the case with Bellingham, there were some pretty clear factions that showed up last night.
Yeah, there were. I think what really fascinated me was that, you know, the people that are and I like to get back to this issue of the vacancy rate, because I think that is really key. But there are people that do not want infill in their neighborhoods because they bought their house understanding that there would not be such a thing. And, you know, we can call them NIMBYs, but I don't prefer to call them that. They're people that are concerned about, you know, the neighborhood that they invested in.
Okay, I'm sorry. Why do you have a problem with
that?
You think it's pejorative?
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay.
And I think that their concerns are not easily, you know, put into a box and put up on a shelf like that. And then the other group were the developers, and they always have their own particular perspective. But what I thought was really interesting last night was, even though they attended, they stood down and they let other people speak. And the community that really spoke last night, and it's a community that we do not hear from very often, and it's the community of renters. And I'm glad that they had their chance. I'm glad that, you know, they didn't have some developer in there saying, yelling about regulations and we need incentives and we need tax breaks, and that did not happen, but people shared their real stories.
And it was a really diverse group of people that shared. I thought, you know, it was students, it was, you know, people in their mid to late 30s that are working jobs that are good jobs. I mean, I'm a renter, and I'm in the same situation. And my rent has been increased by $200 in the last year without any improvements or anything like that. And, you know, it was very positive.
Yeah. I what I was going through my mind was, I wonder how many people in the audience, when they put the rental inspection program in, they put a price tag of $8 a year for their rental inspection and registration. And I wonder how many people in that room's rent went up $100 a month because somebody that owns the property is going to be paying $8 more a year.
Yeah, I think that the overall tenor of the event was really positive. And it was, in contrasted to a lot of very heavily attended city council meetings, it was largely people getting up and telling their stories and actually offering ideas. And there was actually some really, great things going forward. And I hope that the council was paying attention, because there were some very, passionate, strong, and not the strident sort of thing we've seen so often.
Absolutely. Tim and I were talking before the event started, and I remember you saying, it doesn't seem like a lot of young people here. It doesn't seem like a lot of the people who need to weigh in the most. And then we were so fortunate to have such a strong contingent of people who are young, who are facing a concatenation of different conditions that they are struggling with and are going to continue to face those in Bellingham if they stay. And some people said that they were going to be run out, which we've seen in this city over and over again.
Yeah. And I guess one comment I would make is that, it was terrific that they had Rose from Sustainable Connections up there, and she has been involved in some of the high quality, fantastic, fabulous infill projects. But the reality for Bellingham is most of those projects are terrible. And that's why people don't want them in their neighborhood, is because, and this is something I think the city needs to grapple with, is the quality of infill. Because I think that if you told a neighbor that they were going to get some kind of super high quality and beautiful development next to them that's got small houses and shared yards, I think people's excitement would go up, but that's not what happens.
Yeah, I totally agree. Right in, my neighborhood, just up Cornwall, there are some really cute little townhouses that were put in, and that's, not super density, but it's density, and they look nice, and they're a good addition to the building. We've got some other things in the neighborhood that kind of look like shipping containers stacked on top of each other, and I'm less happy about those. But if you make the infill projects attractive, I think people will be much happier with it.
Yeah, and I think about communities that are funky, that are weird, that have character. I think that's what Bellingham has always been about, and I think it's what, when I think about a future here, I hope that we have these unique, eco-friendly spaces, and that they aren't relegated to just those that can afford them. And I think it will actually increase the city and the quality of downtown, and that urban environment that is really special.
Right, and we've talked about it, but one of the things that I see happening citywide now, in especially where the infill toolkit is not available, is a property with a modest home on it will be snapped up in a red hot market. The house will be knocked down, and you'll put up a big house on that because the market will bear that. And so a lot of our neighborhood spaces are being bought up and made unaffordable through this process. We can call that the free market, but it has a corrosive effect, I think, on exactly the kind of funky, diverse, creative community that I think everybody most people who live in Bellingham would like to see thrive.
And yet there's that whole balance of people who say that they want to preserve the character, whether that's the funky character, like I live in the lettered streets and you could argue that that's one of the funkier characters. But the area of the letter streets we live in is single family. And I think that that is coming up for discussion. And as with a lot of neighborhoods, that's not set in stone. So you can see where this is going to lead to a lot of questions. But before we get off talking about the public comments, we're going to listen to some of them from last night, including when we listened to our last thing from the panel, Rick Sepler had said, we have done everything that we can do that is legal. And this is what some of the response was.
Hi. My name is John Noble. Rick spoke about trying everything legally possible to alleviate the housing crisis. I wonder what might be possible if we adjust what is legal.
Well, I'm Michelle Stelvich, and I work as a case resource manager, and I work with people with developmental disabilities. And many of them have Section 8 housing. And what I'm seeing is that their leases aren't getting renewed. They're, when they do look for places, there's the apartment complex say, we don't take Section 8 housing. And then when I come to look at the housing and see where my clients are living, I'm concerned about the maintenance of the building and trying. My clients are afraid to say anything because they're afraid that they're going to be, their leases will not be renewed.
I got into the field back in the 70s, hired by Whatcom County to do shoreline management. And what was true then was there weren't enough regulations. Now, the regulations are too complex, too conflicting, and too subjective. And I think anybody who's tried to get a permit other than for a tool shed lately would agree with that.
I'm Michael Shaverio. I have lived in Bellingham for 49 years. I am privileged to own my home now in retirement because of a few factors. One is my age, the other is my skin color, the other is my gender, and the other is the fact that I had a little generational wealth to start out with some years ago when I made my first down payment. I have these privileges that a lot of young people today do not. I believe affordable housing is a human right. Bellingham can do a few things to help move our country toward realizing the reality of housing for all. One, pass a resolution declaring that Bellingham recognizes affordable housing as a human right. Two, work with the tenants' union to support renters' rights. Three, pass an ordinance, as many people have mentioned, preventing landlords from screening out tenants due to income source. Four, work with the KCLT and other nonprofits to increase the percentage of housing stock that is owned by nonprofit land trusts. And five, go further to enact more inclusionary zoning. Find a way to do it as part of a plan to slow down and ultimately reverse the ghettoization of renters who are low income and people of color in our community.
That was Michael Shaverio, and he was had an excellent summation, I think, of the evening and the points that a lot of people had in terms of the things that the city of Bellingham needs to do. He also brought up issues of privilege and who has access to housing and who doesn't. We also heard from John Noble, Michelle Stelvich, and Roger Almscar, who was one of those people who was talking about restrictions and whether or not we had enough or too many. Dave, you had a comment you wanted to make.
Well, just to follow up with what Tim was saying, you know, when I was living in the Columbia neighborhood, I did see a couple of times houses were purchased, torn down, and then something that had, you know, kind of questionable press board construction put in that was bigger and monstery. And you can do that in that neighborhood, but you couldn't build a duplex.
Correct.
You couldn't. Mm-hmm. Do something because of the rules that we have in place. And, you know, I think that, you know, we talked about it. Greg Winter talked about the Fair Housing Ordinance. You know, sitting in the state legislature, there's a bill that's passed the House, it's languishing in the Senate, that would establish housing as a fundamental right in Washington State. And those things are great and those things are important, but we have to change the actual rules on the ground, too.
You know, and I, following up on the rules of the ground, it's interesting. You know, I just as a quick aside, when Roger Almscar was talking and he said that he would like to see more public facilities, I wondered if he wouldn't mind seeing his taxes go up to build those public facilities. I just, that flashed through my mind as he was talking. But, you know, another issue is, and I think this is important for the neighborhoods, is it's not just the housing, it's also the parking. because you bought your house, you like to park out, you like to park on the street. Suddenly you can't because there's been a lot of infill, a lot more people are living in the neighborhood. So I think if the city is going to move in a direction of different housing types, it would also be interesting to reduce the parking requirement, because almost every development under the city, they have to demonstrate parking or they have to build parking, and they sort of perpetuate a cycle. Whereas somebody that's a renter and they're living, we heard from somebody last night, lives in the York neighborhood, doesn't need a car because Fred Meyer is close by, the Bellingham Grocery Outlet's nearby. But I would bet that when his unit was put in, there was a parking requirement for it. And so I think that it's not just housing, but it's also transportation that needs to, you know, be an integral part of this rethinking of our neighborhoods.
That's a great point. And we have, for a city of our size, we have a fairly good public transportation system, but it would be nice to see a longer comprehensive plan of what do we do if there are more density in these areas that are being served, and how do we serve more far-flung areas.
And I mean, just thinking about landlords and bringing people into providing housing, you know, entrepreneurship and small businesses is seen as something that's really valued in this community. And yet we also have people providing housing that are doing it for profit only and seeing it as something where they just continue to focus on profit. And I think that there's a great need for people in our community to say, you know, we could do this. We could, you know, partner with a agency and be part of homeless housing. We could say, I'm going to buy this building and we're going to do Section 8 and we're going to, you know, choose to do that. And I think it comes down to our policies have to be centered and focused on protecting our most vulnerable community members. And we also need the community to stand up and say, we're going to be a part of this and we want to be involved and we want this in our neighborhood. We want a diverse community. We want our schools to look, you know, that there's income diversity. And it's just, I feel that we are getting lost in the crisis a bit. And, you know, what you said before, Tim, just about not being able to see forward, like, where are we going? What is our waterfront going to look like? Who's going to feel comfortable there?
Absolutely. And I think it's leaving it to the developers to enact those changes for us is not a good policy.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't want to relax any regulations that they have on them.
Somebody last night talked about, I think it might have been Michael, talked about how this is an ethical crisis for the city. I mean, this is the city we want to be. And we're on a threshold right now of it very quickly escaping to a city that we don't want it to be, which is a gated community of high incomes. And everyone lives out in Ferndale or Sumas and drives in to work every day to shine shoes or flip burgers or something. I mean, I that's not the town I want to live in. I want to live in a thriving arts community with plenty of creative people and interesting people and fun and from every walk of life. That's the town I want to live in.
Well, and I don't want to see us, as Dave mentioned before, like San Francisco, where people of a certain income who have historically lived in a place, historically lived in a neighborhood, are driven out. And somebody even mentioned last night about if you have a certain income or if you don't have any income, you might have to find a place in Sumas where, once again, there is no transportation, which is not the city of Bellingham's issue. But it all plays into that. And yet, Melora, I have to say, it's one thing to say, oh, well, we're going to get together and we're going to build this and we're going to have multi-level people in the same neighborhood. But we are fighting people who say, and I'm sorry, Tim, they say, okay, well, I want to do something about homeless people, but I don't want people here. And there's a huge fear, which we didn't talk about last night at the meeting, but it's a huge fear.
I agree. And I mean, I've been at the center of that for quite a few years now. So I hear it and I deal with it. But I think that there's also a large part of our community that is not afraid of that. And, you know, they're kind of busy just living their lives. And I think we really need to mobilize those people to come out to meetings and to be more vocal and to say, this is actually, I do, I want to sign up the lettered streets. I want to sign up a, you know, part of Columbia. We want the York to look like this. And Sunnyland, I mean, all of these really beautiful, fun neighborhoods that we have. And I think we need to organize. I do want to just a little shout out to the Bellingham Tenants Union. Mm-hmm. They were really present last night, and they've been doing some really good work and organizing and mobilizing. But we also need to be focusing on those families that already have and own homes.
And who are the Bellingham Tenants Union? I hadn't heard about them before last night.
Well, I think they're a fairly recent organization. I don't know a lot about them either, but they were well organized and articulate. And it was good to see them because that's a cohort that we don't get to see very often at city meetings. So I was glad that they were there. I don't know their history, how long they've been formed, but I suspect that they formed fairly recently, and they probably rallied around the rental licensing and registration movement and coalesced from there into a more formal association.
Absolutely. And I hear you saying, Melora, or maybe I'm just inferring that there's a certain echelon of people who maybe we shouldn't bother trying to change. And that's an exciting look at things because I'm always like, well, how can people just see that this is important? And it sounds like you're saying, let's just move on.
Yeah, a bit. Yeah. I mean, I think there are parts of this town that they're doing what they're doing, and that's fine. And I think there are other key neighborhoods that are, filled with families that really want a diverse community. And I think they need to speak up.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that the subject of the conversation has moved around a little bit because it used to be that the population of concern was not homeless people but students. That I mean, for a lot of the neighborhoods, it's like they didn't. And really, what that comes down to is that's just a behavioral thing, and it's like acting like a good
neighbor.
You're
saying the prejudice of people.
The prejudice against people. You know, I don't want infill because students drive their cars up on the lawn.
And they're loud,
they leave their garbage.
Music.
Yeah, they play music, and they leave their garbage out, and all these behavioral things. I mean, you know, it's like next door is a house full of 20 nuns that get up at 6 o'clock and sing, and then they sing and then they go to bed at 6 o'clock and they don't bother me. But the two students next door, they drive me crazy, that kind of thing.
And I think it's really important to remember when we're talking about homelessness and housing is that when people receive housing, they are no longer homeless. They're not homeless people that live in this apartment, you know, and so it is a huge part of the solution to, you know, people that have been in poverty and are struggling, that giving them a place to live. I mean, Francis Place is a really good example on Cornwall. You know, 3 years of controversy, you know, got really, really intense and pretty nasty. And
tell me about that.
So, you know, it's a permanent supportive housing for adults chronically homeless right on Cornwall behind Boundary Bay. And so when that all kind of came through, it was going through the city. A lot of the merchants came out, mostly merchants, not so much the downtown residents, but came out and said, we do not want this in our backyard. And the developers also wanted that space, right? Because there's a lot of high-rise condos in there. Mm. And most people drive by that building have no idea that it's part of a housing program, have no idea. It's a beautiful building. It was very well built. And, you know, crime hasn't increased. In fact, the numbers show, I mean, they're amazing. I would love to come back and talk about them sometime, but a huge decrease in law enforcement and 911 and EMS services. And so if we actually look at the data, it shows us that housing will improve all of those things that people are really concerned about.
So the merchants came out, but it's still there.
Oh, it's still there. Yeah.
So what happened with that situation?
There was a lot of pushback, and there was some pushback from people that understood there was a need for this, and they pushed on it, and you know we're gonna build this because we understand the need for it. And so they overcame the objections of of the merchants. I think there was a concern that they thought that you would have too much concentration of a particular kind of tenant in mm-hmm. a particular area. That was one of their concerns. But I think you're right. I mean, I think the city's done a really good job of putting in place a lot of mechanisms to help even with that, with their community paramedic program. Now there's like a person on call that can deal with calls that used to go to 911, go to police, now can be handled through a particular person with the fire department. There's other mechanisms like that in addition to, you know, your own mechanisms at Francis Place.
Yeah.
So the merchants, have they come around, do you think?
Yeah, a lot of them have. I mean, a big part of my job is talking to them, checking in, and I found that really they just needed a name and a phone number that I told them they can call any time of the day or you know, at night. Just call if you're concerned. And just that check-in of having someone to listen has helped. And I think we still have a few people that are, they're not thrilled, but we are really trying to be good neighbors. And I think that, you know, the downtown core is more vibrant because of Francis Place. And I think, you know, our neighbors, I hope that over time they'll be saying, either I was wrong, we were wrong, this has been great, or that, you know, it will be one of those huge accomplishments that as a community we can be really proud that we persevered and built it. And it's full, and it's, you know, people are reclaiming and having the opportunity to stabilize their lives.
Man, Melora, how many problems would be solved in this whole, in everything we're talking about, if everybody who was concerned just had a number to call? I'm serious.
Yes.
Like every single person who's worried about the sanctity of their neighborhood, you know, just had a number to call. Every single person who was worried about what was happening. Of course, there's always the city council. I think that they hear a lot. Just want to remind you, you're listening to Cascadia News Now. That's Melora Christensen. You just heard. She's the Associate Director of Housing at Catholic Community Services. Also here, Dave Willingham, Tim Johnson, and I'm Stephanie Contouris. So, Dave, I think you said earlier you didn't know if the city council took any of it to heart or any of the new ideas. I had a quick chat with Terry Borneman last night, and he was very excited about the idea of cooperative condos. And I think that they brought up an idea of, like, people co-owning, like, the entire building. But having been to Vancouver, I'm a little worried about the concept of too many condos in Bellingham. And is it a good idea, or?
Well, condos are a good entryway to homeownership in general. But, you know, I've had numerous friends who have had very bad experiences with very heavily balkanized condo associations. And there have been lawsuits, and there are fights between neighbors, and it's not the only solution. Let's say that.
Well, with our population, no matter what anybody wants, the population is going to increase in Bellingham and everywhere. And I see it as a balance between, we were talking about those lively, funky neighborhoods that we like, and also housing a whole lot of people, and wondering if that's an inevitable solution at some point.
Yeah, as I said, we didn't say this at the outset, but it's important to understand this is a problem that is being seen everywhere throughout the West, and particularly up and down the I-5 corridor, everything north of, like, let's say, oh, you know, Centralia or something like that is experiencing this kind of problem. It's a there's a lot of factors, but a couple of big ones are, first, you've got to have the Growth Management Act that tries to, restrict boundaries to stop sprawl. And so you've got fairly tight boundaries on cities, and those cities, they don't want to just be pavement wall to wall. They want to have parks and whatnot, and so that chews into your land mass. And so you end up with a very finite land mass, and you have to be wise with what you do with it. And if everything that's going in is a house with a four-car garage on it, then suddenly you've chewed up your entire land supply, and you've done nothing to address the sorts of population, income, all, you know, lifestyle, all these other things that need to be talked about. And I think the developers in Bellingham have not been very creative. There's been no need for them to be creative, because if you can sell houses to that group of people, why should you think about doing something different for the other group of people?
Absolutely. And, you know, we are going to continue wrestling with this, as is the city of Bellingham. So we will have ongoing conversations, and you should reach out to your city council person, no matter what your position is. But we just have a couple of minutes. And as always, we do have to get to our Fergie Love Fest, because Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson has been busy this week, as he has been every week. Take it away, Dave.
Well, first of all, breaking news, the Attorney General is going to be participating in a opioid crisis summit tomorrow at the UW. It's happening tomorrow and Friday, 8 to 5. There will be media availabilities, and hopefully some good will come out of that. It's involving a lot of county-level prosecutors and city-level around the state. He's standing up to the federal Department of Education because they're kind of slow-walking some new rules that have been put into place that prevent, like, for-profit colleges from deceiving students, preventing them from signing on to class actions and other bad things that we saw, rules that we saw take shape in the fallout from the collapse of, like, the Corinthian colleges. And the Department of Education has said that they will waive the student debt of those students who were thus scammed, but they have not fully rolled that out yet. And this is a good time, and I'm going to take a slight diversion. There's another major fight that the Attorney General has mentioned only in passing so far, but people who have been a part of the federal loan program, where if you work at a nonprofit or a government job for 10 years and you make all of your payments on time, at the end of that 10 years, your loans, the rest of them are waived.
Supposed to be.
The Education Department has said that that may not be the case. That program went into effect in 2007. So the first people to ever be eligible are just coming due. So that's the next fight with them. And once again, I love our Attorney General.
And the energy efficiency lawsuit. Also, that he that has become a lawsuit now. He wrote a letter in response to Scott Pruitt's criticism of vehicle emissions standards, and he and 12 other governors have signed on. And as of yesterday, that is a lawsuit. Fergie Love, it keeps on happening. Speaking of the environment, we are going to be doing a show on some environmental issues coming up that may or may not have to do with former Vice President Al Gore. But for now, that pretty much wraps it up. If you have feedback, comments, complaints, want to be a guest host, if you want to listen to our shows, give us a shout at CascadiaNewsNow.com. That's CascadiaNewsNow.com. We want to give a super, super special thanks to our engineer tonight, Devlin Sweeney, who was all but heroic. Our technical director, Dave Willingham. Our hosts, Dave Willingham, Tim Johnson, Melora Christensen, and I am Stephanie Contouris. This has been Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.